Good evening. I'm Joseph Fink. I'm the president of Dominican University of California. It is my great pleasure to welcome you this evening to the fifth season of our leadership lecture series. The series is an opportunity for the university to welcome our neighbors and our friends as we learn about leadership from some of the most compelling leaders in politics, entertainment, literature, and academia. The Leadership Lecture Series is the public face of the Institute of Leadership Studies, Marin's Leadership Development Center, just as we are Marin's University. The Institute's mission is to advance the study, teaching, and practice of effective and ethical leadership in our world. It is led by Dr. Denise Lucy, who's here this evening, even though she just got married on Sunday. So let's applaud her for that. The Institute for Leadership Studies is an integral component of our School of Business and Leadership, which is committed to educating students to be socially responsible leaders of sustainable organizations that will make a positive difference in the world. In the past year, our series has welcomed Al Gore, Madeleine Albright, Amy Tam, Isabel Allende, and a host of others. Now, this evening, we're delighted to welcome the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. Before we begin this evening's program, though, let me briefly mention a few things to you about Dominican University. This is the commercial. This past year, we had the largest number of students in the university's history. A third of our students are graduate students. A third of them are students of color with graduation rates better than those at UC. It's important. 80% of our students receive financial aid from us, let alone what they receive from the federal and state governments. Without the support that some of you in this audience give to the annual drive of scholarship funds, those students who are coming from economic backgrounds that could ill afford to attend a university of this type would never have the chance to be here. We're very proud of what we've been doing, as we are proud of the speaker series. And earlier, there were a listing of the number of events that are coming onto the campus. On September 21st, Amy Tan and composer Stuart Wallace will talk about the making of the opera The Bonesetter's Daughter, based upon Ms. Tan's book of the same title. On October 20th, Cherie Blair, the wife of the former Prime Minister Tony Blair, and herself a successful barrister, will discuss her autobiography, Speaking for Myself, My Life from Liverpool to Downing Street. 3 days later, on October 23rd, we're going to have a terrific event here on campus that you're all invited to. It's an event that's built around the presidential election. It's called Vote Smart Challenge 2008. We're excited about it because it's going to showcase the work of our faculty and students that are established in various research teams that are looking at critical policy issues, including healthcare, environment, foreign policy, et cetera. Key representatives from McCain and Obama campaigns will join us as we discuss these issues. It's going to be a dynamic event, but it's going to be a fun event. And the reason it's going to be fun is the audience. The audience will, using handheld devices, be able to vote upon the issues that are going to be presented. Responses will be immediately calculated, and real-time results will be discussed. So I invite all of you to join us. The event is intended to bring the campus and the community together at large so we gain a better understanding of the issues affecting this election year. There are many more exciting events, concerts, and exhibits hosted here throughout the year. Please check our website, dominican.edu, for updates. And if you want to listen to this lecture a little bit later, it's being broadcast on Penguin Radio. At radio.dominican.edu. It's being broadcast live and it'll be repeated several times during the course of the week. Let me Let me also now recognize our partners in this venture. Please join me in thanking Elaine and Bill Petricelli for making Book Passage such a vibrant resource for learning in our community. Please. And please join me in recognizing Marin Magazine also. Each month, Marin Magazine brings its readers the very best of what Marin County has to offer through stories and profiles of the people who make Marin County so special. And with us tonight, to introduce our program, is the publisher of Marin Magazine, Lisa Schanauer. And Lisa, if you would come out and join us, we can begin the program.
Hi, everybody. Good evening. It is an absolute honor to be here tonight and to be in partnership with Dominican University of California and our friends at Book Passage on the Leadership Lecture Series. I am also deeply honored to introduce Madam Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, mother of five, and Elaine Petricelli, mother of four. Two absolutely amazing women, and they have had a decades-long friendship, so you will enjoy watching their interaction this evening. Just a note of interest, Elaine's son recently graduated from NYU with a law degree, and he had enjoyed an internship in Nancy's office, so it's a nice fun fact. But these two women share an amazing passion, and their passion is to build and create community. And we at Marin Magazine share in that same goal, and it is our goal each and every issue to create and nurture the communities that are Marin Magazine, that create Marin County, and we're thrilled to bring it to you each month. But these two individuals and these women inspire us with their leadership. So as you all know, we are here tonight to enjoy a conversation with Elaine and Madam Speaker as they speak about Madam Speaker's new book, Know Your Power, A Message to American Daughters. So just a few words about our speakers, and then I will scoot. First, a little bit about Elaine Petricelli and her husband, Bill. Elaine is the founder of Book Passage, which is one of the finest independent bookstores in our entire country. I agree. And being an independent has certainly its challenges, but its amazing rewards for the community that I was speaking about. Book Passage has been in business for over 30 years. They have two locations, one here at home in Marin County, and a beautiful new location in the Ferry Building in San Francisco. So if you haven't had a chance to see that, please do visit. But what's amazing about Book Passage is that they offer incredible writing workshops, but they also welcome over 700 authors each year to their two locations. So virtually any day of the week, you can walk into a Book Passage and find an amazing author, from Barack Obama to Courtney Love to the amazing relationship that's here this evening with Madam Speaker. So please make sure you avail yourself of those incredible community offerings. Madam Speaker Nancy Pelosi has left an indelible mark on American history. And as the first woman to become Speaker of the House, she is the highest ranking elected woman in the United States and second in line for the presidency. In writing Know Your Power, Nancy speaks about the challenges and the joys of crashing and breaking down the marble ceiling. And she has left a passageway and a history for our American daughters and their granddaughters, for futures to come, for she has led their way to allow them to have success. Ladies and gentlemen, please raise your hands in welcoming Madam Speaker and Elaine as they discuss the openings and the opportunities and the choices that were made that brought Madam Speaker to her place in the community today. Thank you very much. We have to stand up again.
Thank you.
Elaine. Well, this is really exciting for me. I met Nancy Pelosi about 30 years ago. And Nancy, at that time, you were a busy, busy mother of five very active children. Could you, I remember when the magnificent Sala Burton asked you to run for office. It seemed such a long shot. Would you tell us how you moved from busy mommy to extremely busy Speaker of the House, or at least Congresswoman?
Well, thank you, Elaine, for your question, and thank you all for being here this evening. I want to thank President Fink for the hospitality of Dominican University. It's an honor to be back here, to thank Lisa for her kind words of welcome and the great work she does at Marin Magazine, to congratulate Denise and Fran on their wedding. And I can't believe you had a wedding this weekend and you're here this evening. But anyway, thank you. Thank you. And all of you, for coming. The reason I wrote the book was to answer the question that Elaine posed. Is how did you go from the kitchen to the Congress? How did you go from the being a housewife to being the Speaker of the House? Before I answer it, though, I want to again acknowledge the long friendship that I've had with the Petrocellis. When I met them over 30 years ago, Petrocelli, you know, when you're Italian-American, you sort of gravitate to those kinds of names. You know, it's Bill's name. And we became friends, and when they opened the first book patch, it's a much smaller operation than it is now, and to see it grow. And thank you for taking us through all of the adventures because of book passage that you have. Yeah, thank you, Elaine. And two of my five children are here, my daughter Alexandra with her husband Nahil, and my son Paul Jr., but I don't know where he's sitting, someplace there, and my husband Paul Pelosi. So for us, this is a family affair, as was writing the book. 1 year ago in August, we spent about 5 days speaking into a recorder, giving snapshots of as we remembered our lives, and as I then spent another 5 days around New York, Baltimore, Washington, college, like that, San Francisco, of course, another 5 days. So in 10 days, we had 1,100 pages of reminiscence. Well, that was, we had to establish priorities. That's what you have to do in government. We had to establish priorities. So we decided some would be for another book, some would be for another day, some would just remain in the archive for my grandchildren to read. But I wanted to write the book to answer that question that so many young women had asked me, and what does it mean for them? And some of what I say in the book and the story is a poignant one because it is sad. Our Congresswoman Sala Burton, was the congresswoman from the area. Her husband, Philip Burton, had been the congressman, a giant in the Congress, and he passed away. And 2 terms later, she followed in his footsteps, and then she was diagnosed with cancer. It was sad because I had no idea that she was so ill. She was my personal friend. And out of the blue, she called me and said, I'm not going to seek re-election, and I want you to follow in my footsteps. Really, totally out of the blue. Now, no woman had done that before. You know, usually men choose their successors or whatever, but this was very groundbreaking on the part of Sala, and courageous, I might add, since I had absolutely no interest in running for public office, had never expressed any interest in doing so, and it's just coming out of raising my children. But she said, you love the issues, you've worked so hard, and as a Democratic volunteer, then I became chair of the California Democratic Party, you would love it here. I want you to promise me that you will run. So I said, well, I have to ask my family, see what they think. My husband, Paul, was very supportive, as he always is and has been, and that's important. And then I went to Alexandra, who was our youngest of our five children. We had five children. When we took Alexandra home from the hospital, our oldest child was turning 6 that week. So 4 of them were off in school, off in college. They were gone. And Alexandra was the only one home. She would be going into senior year in high school. And I thought, gee, one more year would have been better. Of course, I had no plan to do this in the first place, but since it's happening, one more year would have been better. So I went to Alexandra very solemnly, wanting her to know that it didn't matter. Whatever her answer was, it was okay with me. But I had this opportunity to run for Congress. No guarantee that I would win, and it was a very tough race. But I said, Alexandra, I have this opportunity, but either way is okay with me, and if you want Mommy to be home with you this next year, just say so, and I'm happy with that decision. To which Alexandra said, Mother, get a life. And I did. Another life. Another life. I hadn't heard that expression before. You have to remember, this is 21 years ago. It was new to me. It was new to me, and I was taken quite aback, but she persuaded me. And then she said, what teenage girl would not like her mother out of town 3 nights a week? So I went to Congress. Then one thing led to another, which we can talk about later. But in the meantime, Sala took just went fast. And I did not have the experience with cancer to know how fast she would go. And 6 weeks from the day she called me, just a few weeks, she passed away. And then 6 weeks from then, we had the election, and I won the nomination. A very hard-fought fight, because nobody ever knew that I wanted to run for office or Congress. But I tell you this story because, so you know how I made this, it's almost serendipitous, this event that happened, this opening, this manifestation of what my fate would be, just to tell you, and especially to some women who are in transition, that you have to be ready for the opportunities, and you have to be very honest, and that I say that in a most complimentary way, about what you have to offer. What you have to offer. Don't minimize anything that you have done. Some people say to me, well, I was for 10 years, I was home raising my family, so I said, no, count that as a giant plus. You're an executive, you're an organizer, you're a diplomat, you're a people person, you have a disciplinarian. That strengthened me more than anything. Being a mother of five, raising the children, gave me the confidence that if I could do that, I could do anything. And so can you.
But those of you who are old enough to remember that election, remember that Nancy Pelosi didn't have a chance, right, was what they said at first.
Right.
And would you tell us about your mother-in-law and her friends in that election?
My mother-in-law is a saint, a beautiful, lovely woman. Maybe I should just put this in a little context. Paul and I have 4 of our children in New York, and Paul's born and raised in San Francisco. We, as newlyweds, we lived in New York, and we had 4 of our children in New York, and he had this wonderful opportunity to come to California, a great business opportunity, and for him it would be coming home. He got this job offer the day our 4th child was born, and coincidence would be. So I said, well, Paul, if that's what you want to do, we'll be ready. In 4 weeks we go, we're going to California. So we go on the plane, 4 babies, the oldest is 4, the youngest is 4 weeks, Paul Jr., who is here. And I had said to Paul, I had one condition, which was I cannot stay at anyone's home. To this day, I don't like to stay at home. I like to have my own space. So I cannot stay. I have a routine with these 4 little children, and I cannot stay at anyone's home. So we were going to have an adventure, stay in a hotel, get an apartment, go from there. On the plane, somewhere between the second and third singing of California, Here We Come, Paul says to me, there's just one thing I have to tell you. My mother, Nana, the saint, no, she's an angel, Nana would be very offended if we didn't stay in her house at least the first night, because here are the babies coming, she'll want to receive them. That wasn't the deal. Okay, but one night, 4 months later, we move out of Nana's house. And the story that I like to tell about that is that You know, I wanted to go to law school, as you'll see in the book. I thought I was going to law school. Instead, I got married, had 4 children in 4 years, but I still had this thought that I would go to law school. Paul did not want to go to law school. He made a decision that he did not want to go to law school. He wanted to go right into business. So one day, we're sitting in the, like a Saturday morning, it wasn't a work day. We have the little children crawling around the floor, largely in diapers, and I'm feeding one of the baby and this or that. And it was really a sight to behold. So I looked over to Paul and I said, Paul, at least we're happy. Just think of what you would be without us. Without missing a beat, 2 rooms away, Mrs. Pelosi says, an attorney. An attorney? No, I'm going to be the attorney. So for 6 years at least, you have been harboring this idea that we were preventing Paul from being an attorney. Well, now we fast forward to the election, but my mother-in-law, there was no nicer, sweeter, dearer person. We just didn't know that she wanted him to be an attorney. But in any event, and she's not even Jewish. But she would have said a doctor. Right? So anyway, so we fast forward to this election, and there was no chance that I was going to win, right? But I promised Sala that I would run, and so I kept my promise, and I figured out how I could win, but it would take a lot of work. And what it took was Elaine Petrocelli was getting out the Italian-American vote, which usually, 21 years ago, was not the first to stand in line to vote for a woman. I say that with the greatest ethnic pride, but with a concern about that subject. Anyway, Nana and her Nana friends created something called the Nana Brigade. And the Nana Brigade called 8,000 registered Italian-American surnames in the district and turned out the Italian-American. I think they got a few Hispanics in the mix. But nonetheless, she was very instrumental in, while not having an attorney for a son, a lawmaker, a lawyer for a son, a lawmaker as a daughter. But in any event, an attorney. I always tell that story on Paul. I don't know how much he enjoys it. What do you think?
And you got to Congress. But as I recall, you were supposed to be very quiet when you first got there. I had never known you to be very quiet.
Well, my campaign slogan was, a voice that will be heard. Did I say it loudly enough? A voice that will be heard, because the idea was that working in the Democratic Party as a volunteer all those years, I knew a lot of the members of Congress working on issues, and knew a lot of the members, so my voice would be heard. So I go to get sworn in, and some of my colleagues said to me, first day now, it's pretty exciting, my father is there, who had served in Congress and from Maryland 50 years before. Anyway, they said to me, when you're sworn in, don't say a word. Do not say a word. This is the tradition. You are not to say a word. So I said, well, wait a minute. I'm the voice that will be heard. No, don't say a word. So so Jim Wright was the speaker at the time at the podium. He swears me in, and then he says, would the gentle lady from California wish to address the body? Oh, my gosh. So I wasn't supposed to say a word, so what did I say? But I said, I represent the great city of San Francisco, and I said to my constituents that I am coming here to fight against AIDS. I will tell them that Sala sent me, to emphasize the woman, Sala sent me, and I'm here to fight against AIDS. Just very brief, maybe a few more things acknowledging my father. So I went back to my chair thinking, my maiden speech, I talked about HIV/AIDS. Now, this is 21 years ago. It was devastating tragedy in our community. All these same members, I'm looking at them thinking, I was brief. Why are you talking about AIDS? Why would you want anybody to know the first thing about you is that you're here to talk about AIDS? Why did you do that? I said, I did it because that's why I came here. That's why I came here. Now, I knew right then and there was a little problem with some of them in terms of shall we say, our spontaneity and our purpose in being someplace. But it was a different place. 21 years ago, there were 20 women in the Congress. Now we have about four times that. And when I say the Congress, the House. We have about four times that. It's still not enough, but we've worked very hard to grow that number, and I hope that many of you will be inspired to do so. Not until Lynn Wolfe is finished, mind you, but nonetheless. And Elaine, if I may just at this point say that one of my best friends when I went to Congress was Barbara Boxer. She still is to this day. It was when Barbara was a House member. And let me hear your questions, and I'll talk more about Barbara. But when I got elected, here I was elected. Say I elected on Tuesday. On Saturday, I go to the store to buy some stationery to write thank you notes. So I go in the store, and I'm looking how you're in the store. You don't know if you're going to buy something. I'm looking around. From behind the counter, a woman says, "I know who you are." I just got elected 4 days ago, and she knows who I am. You're Barbara Boxer. So I said, no, I'm not. I'm not Barbara Boxer. I was like, no, my God, she didn't know. No, she should not know who I was. She doesn't know who Barbara is. Yes, you are. I said, no, I'm not. But she kept doing that. And then finally I said, no, I'm Nancy Pelosi. To which she said, are you sure? So many more times being very complimented to be mistaken for Barbara. I had no better friend when I went to Congress than Barbara. And I'll tell you another Barbara story in a minute.
Well, I'd love to know about what it was like as women welcomed you into the Congress. But it must have been a little concerning for some of the old boys.
Yeah. Well, it was a different place in those days. I dubbed what I observed there as the secret sauce club. The men, they had the secret sauce. Don't worry, we'll take care of that. We had the recipe. You could never understand it because you don't wear a suit and tie. But don't worry, we'll do your work for you and we'll take care of the things that you're interested in. And of course, I didn't have a whole lot of time for that. They didn't have time for my speeches. I didn't have time for their secret sauce. So, so what we had to do was pull back the veil, and that's part of what I want women to understand, especially younger women coming into this. There is no secret sauce that they have. At least it's not any better than what you can cook up, to carry the analogy to another sort. But it is, they were the old bulls, and they were pretty dominant. When we went out of power 12 years ago, and then we came back into power, now, 12 years, you know, they were sort of tapping on my head, okay, we'll take care of that. 12 years later, we come back in, and now I'm the Speaker of the House, and they know that. I mean, they've gotten the message. The gavel. But anyway, the story that I love to tell that I think exemplifies what it was like 21 years ago in the Congress with 435 members. 20 women only. Ridiculous. So Barbara invited me to join her at something called the Tuesday Night Club. We would go to dinner with our colleagues. There were only three women, Barbara Boxer, Barbara Kennelly of Connecticut, and Nancy Pelosi. I mean, the other women would join us from time to time, but we were sort of the regulars, with about 15 of our colleagues. And Tuesday nights, we would go have dinner. And what I learned when I went to the first dinner is that nobody ever... You know, it's everybody talks at once, and if you want to say anything, you have to jump in, and you that's just the way it is. In fact, socializing with them, I had to be reacclimated to polite society when I came home because I would interrupt people, just talk when they were talking, because that's how it was there. Because nobody ever asked us, "What do you think?" to the women. "What do you think? If you want to say something, you had to just talk over them." So that's the way it was. We held our own, shall we say. So one night, they had a discussion. Don't ask me how or why it came up. Maybe somebody was having a baby in their office or something, one of them. And the subject of childbirth came up. So Barbara and I were looking at each other thinking, they'll ask us about this subject, right? So here they start. Oh, yeah, well, I had my first. Oh, we had, it was such a tough labor. And it lasted all this time. And well, I had on my green gown, I had on the green hat, and the rest of the doctor said, you're not coming in the room. I'm like, what do you mean? Well, the next time he let me in the room, oh, my God, I said, I'm getting out of here. The next one, I went in with the camera. I had the camera. My doctor let me in. I went in with the camera, took the pictures. You want to see the pictures I have? No, we don't want to see the picture. And then the other who was going to faint, who was going to this, and who was on about their labor. And we thought we were quiet. 11 children among us, 5, Barbara Canelli, 4, Barbara Boxer, 2. We thought, well, surely they will say, does this make you uncomfortable? Or what do you think? What do you think? Words that are unknown to their speech patterns. What do you think? Even talking about having a baby. So we're looking at each other thinking, they're hopeless. They don't even know. So about 2 weeks later, we were at dinner again, and there was this beautiful member of Congress, Don Edwards, who is a, he was the floor leader of the Equal Rights Amendment, the chair of the Judiciary Subcommittee on the Constitution, the Equal Rights Amendment. A beautiful, lovely man from California. And he said to me in the course of conversation, Nancy, what do you think? And I thought, oh my gosh. And he was surprised at my reaction, and I told him the story. Well, all these same people were at the table that night, too. And they said, that never happened. We would never have done that to you. They didn't even know. They didn't have a clue that they didn't have a clue. But we knew that if we had to wait for them to ask us what we think, it would be a long time before we would be able to make our mark in terms of public policy, in terms of what women think in the United States, and therefore in the Congress of the United States.
You paid your dues 21 years. You became whip not so easily, and then
big fight.
Big fight. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about the progression from the Congress, the person who couldn't get elected, to the Speaker of the House? How, and particularly, I'd love to know more about how you pulled off that 06 election.
The 06 election. Well, one of the reasons that I decided to, see, I wasn't running for Congress, and then Saleh, and that's why I did. I certainly was not running for leadership. But after we lost, and then we lost, and then we lost again, and I thought, you know what? I know how to win, and this is not the way to win. So in order for me to be able to orchestrate a victory, I have to be in the leadership. It wasn't about politics. It was about the 1 in 5 children in America who lives in poverty, was not being, news needs were not being addressed. It was about the fact that 46 million people in America don't have health care. It was about the inequality in our economic system. It was about all of those kinds of things, our environment and the rest. So it wasn't, oh, well, this is politics and we want to prevail. It's the American people's interests are not being served. The special interest at the expense of the middle class are being served. So I want the Democrats to win. So anyway, that's when I asserted myself in a more substantial way. In an organization that is the male dominant organization of all time, for 200 years plus, men have always expected that men would be in charge. It's just the way it was, and nobody should have any other expectation. Both parties, mind you, both parties. As progressive as the Democrats were in their policies outside the Congress, it wasn't about, do you think it'd be a good idea if a woman were in the leadership? That was the last thing you could ever say to anyone. And I think this is important for young women to know. It's not about, you should be for me because I'm a woman and therefore we need a woman in the leadership. It was about, how do I prevail? And so I had to show them that I could win. We showed them how we could win races in California. And it was a very focused, well-organized, determined to succeed effort. Training I received, taking care of my 5 children at home, that's for sure. but also that I learned at my parents' knee. I grew up in Baltimore, Maryland. My father was in Congress when I was born. When I was in first grade, he went to became mayor of Baltimore. When I went away to college, Alexandra knows, he was still the mayor of Baltimore. And we lived a life that was about social justice, that public service was a noble calling. Our fundamentals of our family were our deep Catholicism, our deep, we were devoutly Catholic, we were staunchly democratic, we were proud of our Italian-American heritage, and we were deeply, deeply patriotic. Those were the cornerstones of our existence. When I was little, my mother wanted me to be a nun. God did not bless me with that calling, but Sister Patricia told me tonight when I told her that, she said, "It's not too late." In any event, that was my motivation, this whole issue of economic and social justice and the rest, and how can we just sit around here and lose? How can we sit around here and lose? I know how to win elections. And so they gave me the chance. Now you get the chance, you get the opportunity, you also get the responsibility and also pay the penalty if you don't win, so it's a risk. But I was ready for that risk because it was so urgent in my view. And we just plotted and planned it right to the T. And boom, we won in 2006. It was a great victory. The American people and, of course, my colleagues then, even though I was a woman, elected me the Speaker of the House.
And how lucky we are. We have a huge stack of questions. We could probably stay here for a few weeks. And some of them are a bit similar, so I hope you'll all forgive me. But there are a lot of questions concerned both about the wounds of the Democratic Party and how we heal them, how we get true bipartisan cooperation in the government, and what can the average citizen do? We all plan to vote. But what more can we do to change this country?
Thank you, Elaine, for that question. What I try to convey in my book and what I was raised on was that we all have a responsibility to the future. That is how our country was founded. Our founders, they were so fabulous and so enlightened in the rest. Their whole premise was that each generation has a responsibility to make the future better for the next. They put that on the Great Seal of the United States, Novus Ordo Seclorum, a new order for the ages. So confident were they that this would work, that it would be for the ages. And again, we all had a responsibility to make it so. And so when it comes time for elections, you have to just look at it through the prism of what is right for the future, for our children, for our children. And again, children, my view, my life in politics, as an extension of my role of mother, and what is it that we are doing in terms of public policy for our national security, our growth of our economy, all of the issues, including some very specific issues for children that we are doing. And that's what elections are about. They are a choice. They are a choice of the path that the country will take. So in terms of the Democrats healing their wounds, the difference between the Democrats and Republicans, forgive me, this, I didn't come to make a partisan speech here, but the choice, the differences in terms of being there for the special interest or being there for the people's interest, there's really a very clear distinction between the two parties. So you have to identify with what your beliefs are and choose a candidate who will be, will lead with great intellect, with great values, with great knowledge, with a great plan, and who can get the American people to follow him. I think the choice is clear, but we won't go into that. So so in terms of the Democrats, I think that Democrats are coming together. It's hard. It's really hard when your candidate does not win, because you believe in that person, and that person believes that he or she will be the best possible president. But at the end of the day, that's no longer the choice. The choice is the past or the future. And our heritage of our country is always to choose the future. President Thomas Jefferson said, to get to your civility point, that, and I said this in the day I received the gavel, he said that every difference of opinion is not a difference of principle. And that's something really to remember, because we have many differences of opinion. Thank goodness. If we all thought alike, only one of us would have to go to any meeting. We need the diversity of opinion and the freshness of thinking and the fresh eyes on a subject and women and minorities at the table and rest. But the thing is that civility has to rule the day. We owe it to the American people, as staunchly democratic as I am, we owe it to the American people to try to find our common ground. We have to try to do that. If we can't, we must stand our ground. That's for sure. But we have to try to bring it together. Now, I always say Congress will be more bipartisan the more Democrats we elect to the Congress of the United States. Because finally, the Republican Party will come home to what it was. Great. I mean, we've had great Republicans, Peter Bayer here, a leader on the environment from Marin County, but that's not the Republican Party that is in charge. It's a radical right-wing, extremist agenda, special interest-oriented. It has really not much interest in the 1 in 5 children living in poverty in America. And we have a responsibility to every person in America. And as Speaker, I say to my colleagues that when you come here, your title and your job description are the same, representative. You come here to represent your constituents. In doing so, you have to lead sometimes, have a difference. You know, something might be in the national interest that isn't so well readily apparent back home. So you have to follow the 3 C's. The Constitution, to which you take an oath of office, in your oath of office, and to defend in your oath of office. The Constitution, your constituents, and your conscience. Hopefully they're always in sync. But if sometimes you have to lead your constituents. You have to have the courage to do that. And so we want to return the Congress to a marketplace of ideas. Right now, it's, you know, this war has been a great divider, just a bitter divider in the Congress and in the country. But I don't want, I don't want to use the word legacy too soon here. You know, I just got to be Speaker, but I don't want my legacy to be that we made the Congress more partisan instead. I want it to be that we heeded the words of Thomas Jefferson and made it more civil.
There are several people who are concerned about the conflict going on right now between Russia and Georgia. Could you comment on how our country might be handling that?
Yes, it was stunning to me to see Elaine at the Olympics. Like a split screen, you see tanks and airstrikes going into Georgia, and you see Putin there watching the parade. It's like, what is going on here? I'm very pleased to tell you that today, and we've been working on in a bipartisan way on this, today in the House, we, Democrats and Republicans together, the leadership of both parties, did a joint statement calling for the Russians to leave Georgia, to have a ceasefire, to honor it, to have also a engage in the diplomatic dialogue that is necessary to end the conflict there. If this doesn't happen, just think, if you're the Ukraine or any other former republic of the Soviet Union, you have to be very, very frightened. The other part of it is what role will NATO play, and what role do we play in NATO in that regard? My view is that this is a neighborhood problem for the Europeans, and that any peacekeeping that may be necessary, should largely be done by our NATO allies close in the region. We're carrying a heavy load in Afghanistan for NATO. We'd like our European allies to do more in Afghanistan. Some of them, just 85% of the people in Germany, don't want Germany to be involved in Afghanistan, not Iraq, forget that, Afghanistan. So at the very least that they can do is to keep the peace in their own backyard. And I'm not saying there would never be a role for any U.S. military in any peacekeeping operation, but I would hope that, first of all, this could all be done through diplomacy a second of all of that it would be done with Europeans on the ground for peacekeeping purposes.
We have a lot of questions about education, but I'm going to read this one because it says, I'm a third grade teacher and would like to know how you'd support public school teachers who are losing their passion to teach because of the testing mania. It seems politicians use us as a battering ram. And as a former teacher, I feel for this person.
Yes. Well, thank you for being a teacher. Thank you for your question. One of my daughters is a teacher and one of my sons-in-law is a teacher, so every day I get these kinds of questions on the phone or at the dinner table or some other way. And we certainly in our country, for all the greatness of our country, have never, in current times, rewarded our teachers for the work that they have done, that they are doing. And we just passed a higher education bill. I know you're a third grade teacher, but we just passed the higher education bill, and in it we have a consideration for teachers. Teachers are now practically supplying supplies for their classrooms out of their own pocket. And now in this bill, we're making that tax deductible or having an allowance for them to do that. But that's just one thing. What we have to do is pay the kinds of salaries to our teachers that reflects the value of their contribution. And it is the most important contribution. Education is not only important for the children, for our society, it is essential to a democracy. And public education is essential to a democracy. You're referring to the No Child Left Behind legislation. We haven't done anything with that with the new Congress. We'll take it up when we have a Democratic president in 87 days, but who's counting? But when it comes to our children, it's a most serious responsibility, but we're interested in outcomes. We want all the kids, and every, kids around here probably have every possible opportunity in public education. Some other places, not so. We want every child to have that opportunity. Central to it is, the quality of their teachers, and in central to that is the appreciation we show for that service. So let's put it in a bigger context. Nothing, absolute statement of fact, nothing brings more money to the public treasury than education. Whether you're talking about early childhood, K through 12, higher education, post-grad, post-doc, whatever, lifetime learning, in every aspect, educating the American people brings more money to the treasury than anything else. Any tax credits, any this, any that. So recognizing that, wouldn't we want to have the best possible education? And wouldn't we want to realign our priorities in a way that we make investments in education that are shared by our teachers? And in terms of No Child Left Behind, we certainly want to set standards for our kids. But I've heard all over the country, every place I go, usually I visit a school and I hear we're teaching to the test, we're this or that. George Miller, who's the chair of the Education and Labor Committee, understands this full well. This was an attempt at bipartisanship 8 years ago, 7.5 years ago, when President Bush became president. And the idea was a good one, except they didn't keep their promise, and the administration didn't keep its promise in terms of the money. It was a mandate without the money. We're now about $70 billion behind in funding No Child Left Behind. So it really didn't have a chance from the start. Having said that, we need to fund it, but we also need to change it. Or just, it is the worst brand name in the country. Mm-hmm. What was the most beautiful aspiration, No Child Left Behind, become the worst brand name in the country when you talk about that in education circles. So we hear what you're saying. And whatever priorities we have in our budget, which is a statement of our national values, we must value the contribution of our teachers in terms of what they make so that they can do justice to their family obligations, the schools in which they teach and the conditions of their schools and the rest. And let me just say this, kids are so smart. They're so smart. You tell them education is important. They must study, they must learn so they can reach the self-fulfillment, so they can be a part of a contributing member of society. And then you send them to a school that is dilapidated and falling down and without wired for the future or anything like that, and they get a different message. This is so important. Why aren't you making it? You want me to keep it, have it be important to me. It doesn't look like it's important in terms of public policy, and we have to send a clear message to our children. Same thing with healthcare. Don't smoke, it's bad for your health. Oh, by the way, we can't afford healthcare for you. Same thing with drugs or anything like that. It's bad for your health. So just realizing that that nothing is more important to a democracy, nothing brings more money to the treasury, no profession is more important to the future of our country than our teachers. We have a lot to do, and I welcome any suggestions that you all may have.
Thank you for that. I heard a customer the other day in the cafe saying we should rename it No Testing Service Left Behind because there must be a lot of money in those tests. A number of people are worried about our Constitution. They feel that several of the questions say I'm really excited about the Congress changing and the coming election, but our Constitution has been pushed to the limit under this administration. What should we not be doing right now?
The elections have ramifications, and again, every one of us who is in elective office, and many of you in boards and commissions, and take an oath of office to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States. It's what we do. That's our oath of office. And yet every day, in so many different ways, we see an undermining of the strength of that Constitution. Whether it's separation of powers, balance, checks and balances, whether it's the role of the courts in terms of judicial review, in so many ways, whether it's how the government can collect intelligence on people in our community, it's just not right. And if you had one reason to go down the future path and not the past path, it would be to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States. Our colleagues, and I don't like to be the bearer of bad news, but they have said to us, and if there are any attorneys in the room, not you, Paul, but and not me, but they don't even believe in judicial review. So they said when they were in power, when they had the majority as recently as 18 months ago, they said that Congress could pass any law that it wanted. Now, and could amend the Constitution. Well, you know, amending the Constitution is a very complicated and challenging thing to do. But they said Congress, by a simple majority, can amend the Constitution, and we will strip the court. They have a court-stripping measure in the bill that says we're going to strip the judicial review from the court so they can never say, well, this is unconstitutional. Because judicial review, they said, was wrongly decided over 200 years ago in Marbury versus Madison. Was wrongly decided. So we have real problems with these people. And it's not just about the Constitution in legislation. It's about judicial appointments to uphold a view of this. There are members of the Supreme Court who think that the separation of church and state is a state's matter. It's up to the states. Members of the Supreme Court appointed by the Republicans. So, again, the court system to uphold the Constitution, a president to appoint people who are pledged to do that, and all of it geared to respecting. And I'm going to tell you something. I don't care if it's a Democrat or Republican president. No president should have the ability to undermine the Constitution.
You have to stop for a moment.
That's fine. I got the message. Thank you for your passion and your intellect on that subject. Thank you.
There's a number of young women who have written questions saying, I really want to get into politics. I want to be a leader. What aside from having five children and a great mother, father and mother-in-law, yeah. What can women be doing to get this power that you have told us about?
Well, it's related to an earlier question that you had that I didn't, because you had about five questions into one.
Yes,
about
I did
what
that.
We can do, what each of us can do. And I am so pleased that so many young women, girls are here this evening, and so many of you have told me about your daughters and your aspirations, the aspirations they have, and your support for that. I talk about Saleh, and I talk about my growing up in a political family, but there's something in between all of that, which was hard work. It's hard work, and to be reliable on what you do. You have to follow your own passion. What is inside of you? What is it that you care about? You care about our country. You care about our environment. You care about children. You care about choice. Whatever that interest happens to be, to drive your engine. Just about your community. Not just. That's the most important thing. That's the most American aspect of our society. About caring about community. And so if you have just even take the smallest piece of anything and say, okay, well, we decided that we're going to try to do this, and we'll divide up the work, and we'll all be dependent to do our contribution. If you do what you say you're going to do, you will get a reputation for being reliable. And then one thing will lead to another. But what I want young women to do is to recognize that their contribution is very unique. There is none like it. Their own contribution, whatever their upbringing, their passion, their education, the ideas that they have, the dreams that they have. We have to put a little plan next to the dream to say, this is how I might want to make our society better for everyone. And in whatever way that you channel that. And again, value. This is who I am. I showed up. I have something unique to do. And I will do what I say I'm going to do, take on more responsibility and grow. And have a cause or a candidate that you rally behind, that you prove that you can get the job done. And it is it's a lot of work. It's very satisfying and gratifying because you believe in what you are doing. But I always say, just in your own world, your own young world, and then as you grow, just think, what is my goal? What is my goal? Is my goal about, again, the environment, stopping global warming? What do I know about this subject? Let me learn what I can about it. What plan would I have on how I can make my contribution? Who else can I bring in on it? What other people can I bring together? Because that's what becoming a leader is who else can you convince to follow you? And other people will have their own aspirations and dreams and vision about how the direction they want to go in. And all that mixed together produces something very, very positive for our country. And Eleanor Roosevelt, when I became a whip, when I was first elected to the leadership, which was the tough race, I heard from people from all over the country. And what was interesting to me was the letters I received from fathers of daughters saying, my daughter, I know she can do anything. Well, this is new. I mean, mothers always believe their daughters can do anything. I mean, maybe it's not totally new. My husband knew a long time ago his daughters could do anything. But just the outpouring of support from dads. So there's a different kind of opening for girls and for young women to just shine and do what they want to do. And Senator Clinton in her magnificent campaign for president, my becoming speaker, that's about two people. But it's more than that. It's about our kicking open the door, breaking the marble ceiling, letting many more people in. So I want the young girls to remember, and even grandmoms who might be ready to leave the nest now and go out there and do some other things, that it is so necessary to have the voices of girls and women in the formation of our public policy. It's a different point of view. Women have an intuition. They have a different collaborative way of working together. They certainly can deal with issues regarding national defense and our economy and the rest. They have a personal responsibility for some of the issues that relate to children, because of their understanding of that situation. So there's nothing more wholesome for the political and governmental system in our country than the increased participation of women in that process. So whether it's school, it springs from school or community service or whatever it is, whatever you set your mind to. And one of these letters, when I talked about the dads, one of them was on stationery that had a quote from Eleanor Roosevelt. And it said, the future belongs to those who believe in the beauty of their dreams. Believe in the beauty of your dreams. They're very unique. It's just you.
Madam Speaker, you've inspired us. You've let us into your life. We are so thankful that you are here. So many of the people in the audience are working so hard to make this a better world, and I feel extremely honored to have been able to be up here with you this evening. I know that you've graciously agreed to sign all these books, just the 850 or so. I'd be so appreciative if, when you come up, the speaker has agreed to put a sign to you or to your mother or your husband or whomever. If we could just do a name, that will be so much better for everybody to get through. Our wonderful Dominican University of California staff and volunteers and the Book Passage staff will help everyone make sure that we all get our books signed. I have mine signed. I'm so excited. But if you'll give us a couple of minutes, we're going to reconfigure the stage, and we'll be bringing people up by rows. Karen West is here to help us do that. But Speaker, Madam Speaker, your father, Congressman D'Alessandro, and your mother must have done such a magnificent job to have this gift to this country.
Well, you're so sweet to say that. And if I may, because you brought up my parents, and since we're at Dominican University, I just have to close with this story. And that is, when I became the speaker, I mean, the day that they were going to nominate me to be speaker in the Democratic caucus, because that's where the majority was and that's where the speaker was nominated, when they nominated me and I went up to the... But I was still busy from the election. I hadn't even really finished my other races. I still wanted to win a few more. We were still recounting votes and the rest of that. Anyway, they nominated me, so I went up to the podium. And the chairperson, Rahm Emanuel, who's the chair of the caucus, he leaned over and kissed me and said, "Your parents would be so proud." And it took me back. It took me back to being a little girl from my parents. It took me back to being a little girl to Baltimore, Maryland, to Little Italy, where I was raised. And I thought, my parents, they didn't raise me to be Speaker of the House. They raised me to be holy. That's what they did. And that's what they would have been proud of. And so it was just such a jarring thing. But I do know that they probably would be proud that I'm Speaker of the House, and they'd like me to be a holy Speaker of the House. I just want to thank Elaine Petricelli, to thank everyone associated with Dominican University, to all of you for coming this evening, and to the young women who are here. I want you to know your power. Thank you all very much for coming. So we're going to stay here.
Well, there it is, folks, radio.dominican.edu, live from Dominican University of California, Tuesday the 12th of August, and we have been so proud to have been able to bring to you the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House in the House, right here at Dominican University of California. We welcome you to come back and download it, listen to it again and again, the Speaker with her inspiring words. Here on radio.dominican.edu, this is Stuart Horn, and you have been listening to a live broadcast from Dominican University.